This is the United Nations Oral History Program's first interview with Pauline Frederick, taped at her home in Westport, Connecticut, on 13 and 23 April and on 4 and 24 May 1984. The interviewer is Norman Ho.
This is the first of a series of interviews which you, Pauline, have kindly agreed to tape for the United Nations Oral History Program. We are privileged to have your participation in this program, not only because of your unequaled first-hand knowledge of the UN since its inception, but because the widely recognized excellence of your coverage of the organization has made you a United Nations celebrity in your own right. To many people abroad as well as in this country, you are known as the voice of the UN. Your career as a political reporter and commentator in broadcasting broke new ground for women in a field traditionally dominated by men. To mention just a few of the many honors you have been awarded over the years, in 1964, you were named Woman of the Year by the American Association of University Women for your contribution to international understanding. For two straight years, you are the only journalist among the world's 10 most admired women as rated by the Gallup poll. You are also the first woman to win the George Foster Peabody Award for your contribution to international understanding in covering the UN, and the DuPont Commentators Award for outstanding work in interpretative radio reporting. At last count, I believe the number of honorary degrees awarded to you by various universities and colleges stood at 22. I'm sorry to be going on at such length, but I feel that these facts are relevant to this oral history project, and I know that you are too modest to speak of them yourself. Before the United Nations came into existence, you were present when Roosevelt and Churchill met in Quebec in 1944, and when the UN Charter was drafted in San Francisco in 1945. Since the United Nations was founded, you have devoted a working lifetime to informing people about its aims and its work, by radio and television, by the printed word, and by public speaking engagements all over the country. These activities have generated an enormous amount of material, which, fortunately for us, you have kept. Later on, we may deal in more detail with specific issues and personalities, but for today, I propose to take you through a general overview of the United Nations as you have seen it grow and change over four decades. Now, at last, you will have a chance to get a word in edgeways. Would you begin by telling us something about your early life and family background?
I was born in Pennsylvania in a little coal mining town in the mountains called Gallitzin. And interestingly enough, it was named, I was always told, for a Prince Gallitzin, a Russian prince, who was sent to this country to convert the heathen. Well, obviously, that was before communism. Anyhow, in that little coal mining town, my father was postmaster, and he also had a so-called dry goods store with his brother-in-law. When President Wilson came to office, father had to look for a new job because he didn't belong to the right political party. So we soon moved on to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and then on to Tyrone, Pennsylvania, where I was in first grade, and eventually to Harrisburg, where I could say that I really grew up. I was the middle child of three, a younger brother, an older sister. My father, after leaving the postmastership in Gallitzin, became associated with the state government in Pennsylvania in the Labor Department, and I recall one of his first jobs was as a mediator in strikes, and he used to go to places like Pittsburgh to try to help mediate a strike on what was the street railway, the trolley system in Pittsburgh. I finished grammar school, went to junior high school and high school in Harrisburg, was in the last class of the old Central High School, graduated mid-year 1926, and then on to college in Washington. My mother was a very sweet lady who had no interest in careers, but just was a sweet homebody, and my father took very good care of her. It was a very simple home. We had our illnesses and our happiness periods, and I remember occasionally winning prizes for writing some silly little essay, so that in school I was teased as Polly the prize winner, and I hated that like everything. I remember running away from the kids on the way home from school because somebody started calling me Polly the prize winner. I just hated it. But the prizes weren't important. It just so happened that the announcement would appear in the local paper, and then the next thing I knew, my father was out showing all the clippings to the neighbors. I was so embarrassed. But anyway, he was a great supporter. I suppose my first public relations helper.
You were also editor of your school publication when you were in junior high school, weren't you?
That's right. That's right. For some reason or other, I'd always had an interest in journalism from the... It was not called journalism then. That was much too pretentious. But in reporting and getting the story out to other people for them to read, I was always interested in that from the time I could reach... Well, we didn't have typewriters in those days, but by the time I could reach a desk where I could use a pencil or a piece of paper. And I went to camp a couple of times in summer and found an old mimeograph machine where I could, and fixed up a camp paper. And in Harrisburg, I had an opportunity to send in so-called news to the local papers. It was about the school dances or Mrs. John Doe a visit from Camp Hill visiting Mrs. Richard Rowe on Green Street, or something of that nature. So that by the time I was ready to graduate from high school as president of the class, I was asked by one of the local papers if I would come in and substitute for 2 weeks for the social editor who was going on vacation. I did so, and one of the first things I was asked to do was to cover, of all things, a major musical event, one of the great masses. And I was asked to cover that. And I didn't know the first thing about music, so I asked a friend if he would go with me, and he knew something about music and helped me to try to cover this, which I did. Well, anyway, after the 2 weeks covering weddings and all kinds of social events, and to say nothing of this great musical event, which lasted 3 nights, I was asked by the editor if I would like to have the job as social editor, since the social editor had decided she was going to be married. I said, no, thank you. I was going to college.
You obviously had an early bent for journalism, but you went on to major in political science at the American University in Washington and later received a master's degree in international law. What made you choose those fields of study, and what eventually brought you back to journalism?
Well, I tell you, it was a matter of fate, I think. I decided I wanted to go to the American University in Washington, a very new institution, because first of all, I wanted to be in Washington, and secondly, as the daughter in a Methodist family, I was entitled to apply for a small scholarship, which of course I needed very much, and my family needed, because our income was very low. And so I chose American University because I was given this small stipend, which made it possible for me to be in Washington. I went to Washington thinking I was going to major in journalism, but lo and behold, the school was so new that there were no journalism courses. But But there were some very interesting courses in political science and constitutional law. And this was my second interest because of my father's interest in politics in Pennsylvania, I suppose. Anyhow, the instructor for these courses was a young man by the name of Arthur Sherwood Fleming. At that particular time, he was studying law at George Washington University at night. I found his courses most interesting, particularly constitutional law. And then a debate team was set up, and he was a coach, and he asked me to be on the debate team. So I decided, well, maybe I might as well study law instead of trying to go ahead with journalism, since there were no courses in journalism there. So I set my course for law. At the end of my senior year in college, I was about to receive my Bachelor of Arts degree. I had an opportunity to receive a fellowship in international law at the graduate school. Now, I couldn't be sure that this would forward my career in law, but after all, it was a nice fellowship, and I could stay in Washington, and why not take it? So I did. I was about to receive my master's degree in international law after a year when my history professor called me in. He was a fascinating lecturer, Charles Callan Pansel. I shall never forget him. He called me in, and he'd always been very generous in his rating of me in history. He said, you know, Pauline, there are so many lawyers in the world today, and particularly here in Washington, and I don't think there'd be too much chance for a woman lawyer. I think you should go back to journalism. So, saying, I decided that maybe he was right, and it was the best advice I'd ever had. And furthermore, he gave me an idea for launching my journalism career, which I was grateful for and which turned out to be very fortuitous. He pointed out that when a new ambassador, in those days they were mostly ministers, there were very few ambassadors because the missions were not rated that high. Well, anyway, the diplomatic representative of the country came to Washington. He said he always wanted to make a good impression. Now, if I were to interview the wives of these new representatives coming to Washington and work into the interview material about their countries as well as about the women themselves, he thought this would be, might make a very interesting series. So I decided, angels rush in where others fear to tread. I didn't know how to go about it except lift the telephone and call a mission. I think the first one was the Czechoslovak mission. I think that the Czech minister was the newest diplomat to come to Washington at that particular moment. I called to find out if it would be possible for me to have an interview with Madame Weberka, which was her name at that time. And I was asked where the interview would be printed, and I said, well, it all depended on how the interview turned out. So they finally said, okay, I should come. So I went to the mission. The night before, of course, I did a lot of boning up on Czechoslovakia and wrote out questions in a notebook, one question at the top of each page. And the next morning I went to see this beautiful blonde woman. I was ushered into her presence, and she was so gracious and so lovely, and I sat down on the sofa beside her and began asking these questions, and after a while she became a little amused, and she said she couldn't help noticing that I had these questions written out, one at the top of each page, and then I would ask that question and then write her answer. She was very, very gracious about it. And then I said I would like a picture, and so they gave me a picture. So I went off, and then what to do next? Well, there was a new Chinese ambassador, and I decided that I would try my luck there, and the same thing happened. I was able to get an interview, sort of bluffing my way in because I didn't know what I was going to do with these stories. And then the Panamanian minister, and I went to see the wife of the Panamanian minister and did an interview with her. So I had these three interviews. Then what to do with them? I'd written them up. I had the pictures. Where to go from there? I knew slightly a well-known political columnist in Washington at the time by the name of Frederick William Weil. So I decided to go to in to see him and ask him what I should do with these stories. And he said, would you like a letter to the editor, managing editor of the Washington Star? And I said, would I? He said, all right. So he sat down at his typewriter and wrote, Dear Oliver, so-and-so, to Oliver Owen Kuhn, managing editor of the Washington Star, whom I never met and only knew of from afar. I went into the Washington Star with this letter, this package of interviews, and was ushered into the presence of this very dour, rough man who never put his paper down from in front of his face while he was talking to me, just looked at me over the paper. And he said, well, I'd have to leave these things there. You couldn't give me an answer right away. And I said, well, you know, it's very hot in Washington. I live in Pennsylvania, and I'd like to go home for the summer, and it would be nice if I could have a response before I went home. I couldn't possibly give you a response before 2 weeks. So I said, well, that'd be all right. So I went back to the apartment I was sharing at that time with the woman lovely young woman who was the bursar at American University, and she was engaged to Arthur Fleming, and eventually they were married, and I was living with her that summer. And so we were having dinner, and Arthur was there, and the doorbell rang, and I answered the doorbell, and there was a messenger with a package from the Washington Star. And I thought, well, that was over in a hurry. What do I do next? So I signed for the package and went in and started opening it, and there was a letter from Oliver Owen Kuhn saying that if all the other interviews were like these three, he would be glad to take a series every Sunday beginning in October. I nearly collapsed, but anyway, that was the beginning, and from then on, these eventually led into broadcasting. Even though I was diverted from going on to law, for a very good reason, for which I've always been grateful, I was not diverted from my real interest in international affairs. In college, I had been president of the International Relations Club, and of course, I went on to graduate school to study what was then called international law. And of course, the first interviews I did had to do with wives of diplomats, which kept me in very close touch with the international scene. During the period when I was writing these interviews, I was also working on a publication called Uncle Sam's Diary, which was published by David Lawrence. And this had to do with trying to bring into focus in understandable terms the major issues of the day for college students and for high school students. I was assigned in particular to handle the international stories. From the Uncle Sam's Diary, I went on to the United States Daily, which was David Lawrence's big publication then, the predecessor, of course, of the United States News and World Report. And on this publication, I was the correspondent for three departments, the State Department, the War Department, and the Navy Department. In those days, there was no such thing as a Pentagon, thank goodness. but I covered international affairs from those three points of view, so that I have never really been away from the subject. It's always been my particular focus. And then, interestingly enough, not surprising to me, my first broadcast had to do with international affairs. I was doing the print interviews, as I said, for the North American newspaper. I was doing the print interviews, as I said, for the Washington Star. And the North American Newspaper Alliance decided to syndicate them. As a consequence, they were being carried, among other papers, in the New York Times every Sunday, two to a Sunday, with my byline. So one day, the only person I knew in broadcasting in Washington, H.R. Bulkage, called me up and said NBC, New York, was trying to locate me to see if I could do the same kind of interview on the air that I was doing in the Times. I said I didn't know, but they wanted an audition, and since he was the only one I knew who had ever done any broadcasting, I asked him if he would consent to be interviewed for the audition, and he agreed. So I went into a radio studio for the first time, never having been in one before, and did an audition with him. This platter, as they called it in those days, was shipped off to New York over the weekend, and by the first of the week, I was notified that NBC wanted me to do some kind of an interview with a woman on the air. Did I have any suggestions? And I said, yes, I did. It was at that particular moment that Hitler had entered Czechoslovakia and had taken over the Czech diplomatic missions throughout the world. He had ordered them to be surrendered. The minister in Washington had refused, Vladimir Hirban. His wife had been born in this country of Czech background. So it occurred to me, as I told the New York people, that it would be interesting to do an interview from the Czechoslovak mission to indicate that this was the one little piece of Czech soil left in the world. And I would do the interview with Madame Hurt. And that I would like to do the interview with Madame Hurban. They told me to go ahead and have it ready in 2 days. Well, I rushed out to the Czech mission and asked to see Madame Hurban, told her my plan, and she looked at me and said, oh, I'd be much too frightened. I couldn't possibly do it. I asked her if her husband was home. And she said, yes, he was in the library. I asked if I might see him. She said, yes. So we went down to the library. I told Minister Hurban what I had in mind. I said I thought it would be interesting for Americans in particular of Czech lineage to know that there was one little place left in the world that was Czech. And that was the legation in Washington, and that his wife would do a great service by responding to the interview. And he looked at her and said, dear, I'm afraid you'll have to do it. So came the preparation for that, trying to bring in the story of what had happened to Czechoslovakia and how her reaction would be. And I worked on this interview the night before with a fever of 102 from sheer fright, because I didn't know what in the world I was getting into. Went out to the legation the next morning to prepare for the interview, which was being conducted from the legation itself. And I found Madame Hurban looking very wan, and she said, I haven't slept a wink. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I haven't either. And she said, would you like a glass of wine? And I said, yes, I would. So we sat down and had a glass of wine and then did the broadcast from the Czechoslovak legation in Washington. And my first introduction to broadcasting.
Your early years as a journalist in Washington were during the times that were rapidly changing under the Roosevelt administration. Later, President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill were among the first to conceive the idea of establishing the United Nations. What were your impressions of these two leaders when you attended their meeting in Quebec in 1944?
These were two fascinating personalities, of course everyone knows by now, and to see them in the flesh was quite an experience. Roosevelt, with his cape and his cigarette at the angle that he always carried it, and Pudgy Churchill with his cigar. It was interesting to see these two men together who had been talking so much behind the scenes about making a better world from the time they had signed the Atlantic Charter to the fact that eventually they were going to bring about a new effort to try to save the world from war through the United Nations. That afternoon in Quebec, there was a slight interruption to the high-minded purpose of the two men as they sat there about to begin their news conference. A little dog wandered out, Fallo, the famous dog of President Roosevelt, wandered around, sniffed at the feet of the great men, and then lay down in front of Churchill with its legs extended and lay there throughout the conference, while everyone tried to be very serious and listen to what was being said. I'm afraid there was more attention paid to Fallo than there was to the great men.